Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, brought to you by the DeSai Group. The DeSai Group, getting the real work of innovation done. Visit them on the web at desai.com, DeSai.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from the Radio X studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here's your host, Stone Payton.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is Stone Payton with my personal commitment to you that as soon as the voiceover guy gets out of rehab, we're going to have him back in the studio, have him cut a new intro because there's a lot going on, a lot's changed. My partner and now co-host Todd Schnick is in the studio with us each Monday morning. What's happening, Todd?
Oh, you know, having a great day. You know, my contract stipulated a new voiceover on day one. It's been about a month now, so.
We get him cleaned up. We'll get him in here, and we'll get that handled for you, okay?
I appreciate that.
So what's going on this week? A lot happened over the last few days. Get us caught up.
Well, gosh, I think the two biggest pieces of news is that the High Velocity Radio Show now has a flagship sponsor, PSI, the digital media expert. So we're really excited about that. You can find out more about them on the website, which can be found at highvelocityblog.com. And that's just this is the very beginning of this relationship with PSI, and we got some big things planned down the road. But we're excited to have them as part of this family. So, I think the other exciting news, Stone, is we got Lee with us here in the studio, our producer, Radio X. We had our first X Awards last week, and Amy Auto, the host of Atlanta Business Radio, was our first winner.
Yeah, big surprise there, huh?
We knew
we were gunning for her, right?
Well, that was our target in the campaign, but she did a great job and has a great show and a big following. I don't know why, but she's got a big following. But I spent the weekend, Stone, counting up all the money that we raised for the Furniture Bank, and the Furniture Bank was the true winner of that campaign.
How'd we do after you took your cut?
We have like $5 left after I took my cut. But the great news is that we are going to be able to provide beds to children in two families. And so the dramatic impact on those lives is very special to all of us, and appreciate everybody who participated in that event and donated that money. And next time we'll do more to steal more votes.
That's right. We'll be back in the fall, won't we?
Yes, we will. Yes, we will.
Well, thanks for getting us updated. We have a marvelous show for you this morning. I'm delighted to let you know that at the top of the show, we're going to introduce Dr. Steve Bistritz, who has a new book coming out in just a few weeks, I believe. Very anxious to share some news with you about that and really dive into the mind of this gentleman and find out what we can about how and why some people are meeting and serving senior-level executives far better and far more effectively than others. And then after we visit with Dr. Steve Bistritz, then we're going to have technology entrepreneur David Eckhoff on. I don't have a clue what we're going to talk to him about, but we'll unleash Todd on him and see what we can learn from David Eckhoff.
Yeah, we'll figure that out.
But first up on the High Velocity Radio Show this morning is Steve Bistritz. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Good morning. It's great to be with you this morning, Stone.
Well, we are delighted to have you on the show. So tell us, why did you choose to write a book about selling to executives?
Well, Stone, there's a lot of literature out there on selling to executives, but most of it was written by salespeople from an anecdotal perspective. Selling to the C-suite highlights the results of research we did with CXO-level executives where we asked them about their relationships with professional salespeople. So that, from that perspective, we think it makes a significant contribution to the sales profession because it speaks from what the executive was really looking for in their relationships with salespeople.
So what did you ask them?
Well, we asked them a lot of key questions. For example, we asked them when and why they got involved in the sales process or the decision-making process. We also asked them, what has to happen with salespeople for them to think it was an effective meeting. When they had a meeting with a salesperson, what did the salesperson do so that it was an effective meeting from the executive's perspective. And lastly, we asked them questions about what do salespeople have to do to gain credibility with them.
So what was your favorite part about conducting these interviews? Did you learn anything particularly new or something that surprised you?
Well, you know, we did, because when we talked to executives, when we asked them those questions, we got some interesting answers, but more interesting was the perspective we got from those executives. For example, in one of the interviews I had with a CXO-level executive, that's a senior executive in the client organization, I asked him, why would you ever meet with professional salespeople? And I never forgot his answer. He told me that I meet with professional salespeople because often they can offer me advice on issues related to my company that even my own people can't come up with. So I want the benefit of their experience and knowledge because they've seen it in other organizations. And I want to hear about their experience, what they've done, how they solve some of those problems.
So you've hit the big time. You're on the High Velocity Radio Show. You've got this new book that is being published by a little upstart in the New England area called, what is it, McGraw-Hill or something like that?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm just interested to know, how does a person get to this point? You know, a lot of our listeners, Steve, are aspiring authors. They
right.
want to, they are and want to continue to be thought leaders. They want to get published. How does one get to this point?
Well, that's a great question. And let me tell you exactly how it happened, because it was really easy. But then again, I think we hit the right point with our book. And that's the key. I think you've got to have a book that the publisher thinks is going to appeal to some audience out there. And that's what happened with us, because I'll tell you exactly what happened. In September of last year, in 2008, we sent proposals, blind proposals, to four different book publishers. And we didn't have a contact within those publishing organizations. We didn't know exactly who to get to. We sent it to four publishers. And two of those publishers, McGraw-Hill and John Wiley, came back to us and said, we have some interest. Tell us more about the book. And then the other thing that we did is we had the book almost finished, sent it to about 40 or 50 people out there who have some interest in the sales profession, who are recognized sales professionals, and they came back to us with comments, and we included those comments in the book proposal. So it's really about, number one, getting the right kind of book, number two, just getting your proposal in front of some publishers, and then three, having some people that are recognized professionals out there give you some input on the what they thought about the book.
Steve, what I'm looking forward to most about this book is this concept of this relevant executive, the relevant client executive. Can you shed some more light on that?
That's a great question, Todd. Thanks for that. We define what we call the relevant executive as the executive who stands to gain the most or lose the most as a result of the application or project associated with a sales opportunity. And, you know, that is so key, but it's so simple, and most salespeople neglect it. They overlook it. You know, they're talking to some contact in the client organization who's telling them that they're doing great, they've got a great proposal in front of them, and there's some executive in the client organization sitting out there talking to some of their competitors, and you've got to find out who that relevant executive is. And again, it's who stands to gain the most or lose the most as a result of the application or project associated with your sales opportunity. Find that person, and that person can really make the buying decision.
So it might not necessarily be the CEO. It could be a different C-level executive in that organization. And you just got to, the trick is identifying who that relevant executive is.
You're exactly right, because when I worked for IBM, and I spent 28 years with IBM in sales management, and sales executive positions, the mantra with IBM was sell at the top. Always get to that CEO. You don't always have to find that CEO. You have to find that relevant executive who is really on the line for the application or project that's associated with your sales opportunity.
And I get the idea that the target reader for your book is the business-to-business sales executive. Have I got that right?
The business-to-business salesperson, sales manager, sales executive, anybody who's in the area of business-to-business selling is the top candidate for this book. Now, I think other sales professionals can get some, insight from the book, but it's really aimed at the business-to-business salesperson or sales organization.
Steve, do you think, you and I pre-show were discussing the power of the internet and where we still think that the internet and what it means still in its infancy, the internet as we know it's only 15 years old. Do you think that there's a role to play using social media in this space?
Absolutely, because one of the things that, first of all, one of the things we talk about in the book is that the internet marketing is really playing a key role today, and it's going to play more of a role as we move forward. That's number one. Number two, client executives out there, they're using the internet to find out information about the different organizations that are selling to them. So, when a salesperson makes contact with an executive in the client organization, that individual has already done some homework on you. More importantly, the salesperson has to do a lot of homework on the client executive. And one of the ways to find out more about the client executive, him or herself, is to use things like LinkedIn and other social media. LinkedIn, I guess, is more of a business example. But social media will play more and more of a role. Facebook and some of those other social media will be more important as we move forward.
I'm thinking that those tools could be helpful in pinpointing that relevant executive.
Absolutely, because once you, the thing about identifying the relevant executive is you can't do that in one call. You can't do that with one observation of the client organization. You've got to do a lot of work to identify that relevant executive and then start triangulating your information so that you get to that right person who can help you win the deal.
Well, my advanced copy of the book got lost in the mail, Steve. But as I understand it, you did release some advanced copy to a few people in the sales arena that are well-respected and some of us might recognize. One name that I saw that maybe a few people might recognize is a gentleman by the name of Neil Rackham. And I wanted to read a quote because you didn't just get Neil Rackham to blurb your book. I mean, this guy invested the time and energy to write the foreword for this book. I want to read this quote, and it's just one small snippet from a really well-written, well-thought-out foreword. Here's the quote. "This is a refreshing realism about the author's advice. No gimmicks, no tricks, no smoke and mirrors. Selling successfully at sea level is hard, thoughtful, and strategic, and the book offers none of the usual unrealistic silver bullets." I mean, what an endorsement. How do you go about even getting a Neil Rackham to even crack your book open and give us a little history on that whole thing?
Well, one of the things we had to do in kind of researching how we were going to publicize this book was finding out some of those sales professionals out there who we thought, had credibility with publishers. And obviously, Neil Rackham is one of them. When we had the foreword written by Neil, I sent it to my kids, and none of them have ever heard of Neil Rackham. So I tried to explain to them that Neil Rackham was to sales or is to sales like Tiger Woods is to golf. So getting Neil Rackham to endorse a book on selling is kind of like Tiger Woods endorsing a book on how to play golf. But what happened was we sent the book to him, the pre-release copy, early version of the book, and it wasn't totally completed, and he saw it, and first thing he did was he sent back a note, and he said, I get so many of these requests, I review about 10 or 15% of the books that are ever sent to me, so I'm not sure I'm ever going to be able to get an endorsement to you. And about 2 weeks later, we got an email from Neil, and he said, I really loved the book, and here's my quote, and he sent it to us. And then a little bit later, we said, hey, Neil, would you be willing to write the foreword for the book? So just by asking him to do something, he did it for us, and he wrote the foreword for us. He was very generous in doing that. But that also played a role in getting the book published, because when McGraw-Hill obviously saw that quote from Neil, they had published his book on spin selling. They thought quite a bit of Neil Rackham, and they said, hey, we got to get on this, and they did, and the rest is history, as they say.
Tell us about some of the other initial reviews you've gotten.
We got reviews from people like Chip Brubaker, who's a key executive at CA, Computer Associates. We got reviews from other sales executives who probably wouldn't be as recognizable as Neil Rackham, but they are significant sales executives at organizations around the world, some in the United States, some in Europe, some in Asia, some in Australia. So the book has a global perspective, and global executives have seen it and endorsed it and have really liked it. They said that, it's something out there that's going to give, salespeople some insights into how to do a better job of selling at the executive level. And that's what the book is all about, selling to the C-suite.
Selling to the C-Suite is the title of the book.
Yes.
And where can people get access to it, buy it, read about it?
Well, right now you can go to my website, www.sellxl.com, sellxl.com, and you'll see on the homepage, just click on the book, and there's more information about it. You can pre-order it today at any of the online bookstores, and you can pre-order it from my website. So I look forward to people reading the book, and not only reading the book, but getting value from it so that they can go out there and close some of those key deals that they're working on.
Well, Steve, it's been an absolute delight having you on the show this morning. I hope you got a heads up on this, but before we let you go, we do have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show. We'd like to ask each guest, if they would, to share a mistake at some point that they've made in their career, and really, more importantly, what they've learned from it. Could we con you into doing that for us?
Great question, but let me tell you about one. When I was a young IBM salesperson and new to sales, I didn't always focus on executives in the client organization who had the most influence or power. I had no idea that politics was in play in client organizations. I was very naive. My focus was on the contact person that I had already gotten, the person I was comfortable calling on, and that person may not have had any influence or power on the sales opportunity I was pursuing there. My mistake was not spending enough time identifying what I now call the relevant executive. What I learned is that by identifying the relevant executive and aligning with that person, that's the single most important thing you can accomplish as you pursue sales opportunities, because those people can help you navigate the complex structures of the organization and can help influence the decision process in your favor. So that's the one thing I tell salespeople today in the business-to-business environment. Go out there and find that executive that I'm talking about, that relevant executive. You'll reduce the time it takes to close the deal. Very simple.
Well, I can't wait to get the book. I'm sure my advanced copy will find its way through the mail the next day or so. But I'm so interested and enamored with this idea of identifying the relevant executive and then exercising some of the strategies that you learn from doing real-world research as opposed to some guy just, thinking through theory around all this. So thank you so much for being on the show. Steve, can you hang out with us while we interview our next guest?
Absolutely. Be right here.
All right. Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, I am delighted to introduce to you technology entrepreneur David Eckhoff. I met this jean-clad, T-shirt-wearing entrepreneur some weeks ago.
It's our kind of guy.
Yeah, that's him. He's got the backpack and the whole bit. And we talked about all kinds of things that really interest me and candidly sometimes befuddle me. And I just have to admit up front, you're going to find out very quickly, this guy's got several IQ points on you and I both, Todd. But I can't wait to dive in and find out what he's up to and learn what we can about where this world and where the business environment is headed with respect to technology. So with all that said, please join me in welcoming David Eckhoff.
Hey, Stone, it's great to be here today, and you are remarking about my T-shirt and jeans-clad entrepreneur dress. So I really enjoyed hearing Steve in your start of this segment today. I got my start at IBM also, and after too many years wearing white shirts and red ties, It's great to be an entrepreneur, and I spend a lot of time in Silicon Valley and the Bay Area, and it's, I think, standard dress for the black T-shirt and jeans.
Well, you know, we all have an IBM connection. That's how my mortgage gets paid. My wife has a real job with IBM and as a consultant. So thank you, IBM, our second sponsor. I think mostly what we want to talk to you about this morning is innovation in customer experience. Can you expand on that? Tell us what that means to you.
Yeah, so customer experience, and you know, people ask me all the time, so, you know, David Eckhoff, you're a technology entrepreneur. Why are you so interested in customer experience, and why is it so important? Well, a decade ago, there was a big gap in product quality between the number one and the number two and the number three players, and today, that gap is closed. So the key question that we need to ask ourselves as business people is, how are you going to differentiate your product or service? And I believe the great opportunity is to differentiate based on customer experience. So, you know, what is customer experience? And Jeff Bezos, who's the founder and CEO of Amazon.com, he makes the distinction between customer experience and customer service. And he says customer experience at Amazon includes having the lowest price, the fastest delivery, and being reliable enough so you don't have to contact anyone. And that's the that's their customer experience. And then he says you save customer service for the truly unusual situations when things go wrong with the customer experience. This is when you as a customer interact with Amazon employees. And he views this, and their company executes on this, is it's the exception, not the rule. So customer service is a subset of their overall customer experience. And Bezos said something that really got my attention. This is so important, what I'm about to tell you, is fixing customer problems builds loyalty with people. Think about that. That's so important, I'll say it again. Fixing customer problems builds loyalty with people.
That's my favorite thing about social media, David, is that my clients say, "Oh, I don't want to get involved in the social media space because I open myself up to getting criticized online." I say that's the best opportunity you have to build a long-term loyal customer. When you can publicly fix and solve that problem, you're more likely to build a loyal customer long-term than if they came in and had an average experience that you never really knew about. So a lot of people talk about customer experience, and there's a lot of ways to impact that. How does technology play a role in that?
So technology can play a role in multiple ways. And a couple of examples, and I've been paying a lot of attention to customer experience, just myself as a customer, so I'll talk about things from my own personal experience. I'm interested in hearing from your experience too, what you've seen. So technology, a couple of examples. I just ordered an item on Amazon.com recently, and before it even arrived, the price had declined. And I got in contact with Amazon, and on the technology side, they've got something on their website where they make it easy to get in touch with them. They don't just publish their phone number, but all you have to do is enter your phone number, click, and bang, they call you right back.
Oh, that's like cool. I didn't realize that.
And but it gets better. Stone, it gets better. Because, you know, at this point, you can imagine as a customer, I'm not too happy that the price went down. I don't even have the item yet. So I asked them, could you issue me a refund for the difference? And I didn't really think that they would. But I figured it was worth talking to them anyway, since they made it so easy to get in touch. And you know what they did? They said, well, hold on, this particular item is with one of our divisions. We want to connect you to somebody from that division. And of course, you know what happened when the person connected me? They disconnected me. And so technology can have its ups and its downs, but here's where it gets really so much better, is within a few seconds, I got an email automatically kicked off to me from Amazon saying, we noticed you just had a customer service call with Amazon. Did this call resolve your problem? Click here for yes, click here for no. So, of course, I clicked here for no. And then an amazing thing happened. They gave me the opportunity to call them back online, or they called me back. And I was connected automatically. Because I clicked no, the problem wasn't resolved. I wasn't just connected to a first-line customer service rep. I was connected with a specialist who handled customer problems that had not yet been resolved. And she, on the spot, fixed it. Like, nice. How impressive is that with technology to have that happen so quickly? And Amazon is clearly a company that's thinking through that customer experience and how to win people over when things go wrong.
What do you think about Amazon buying Zappos?
Oh, so I'm a big fan of Zappos. Tony Hsieh, the CEO of Zappos, he spoke at South by Southwest this year, and I've been studying what he does. And a couple of things that we'll talk about Zappos in just a moment, but how do I feel about it? I'm a passionate fan of Zappos. Zappos, for those of you who don't know, they're an online e-commerce site. They're primarily known for selling shoes, but they've branched off into other things like clothing, accessories like sunglasses, et cetera. And my own experience with Zappos, I went to buy a pair of sunglasses. And they were really cool sunglasses, and I couldn't wait to get them. And being the cheap SOB that I am and as an entrepreneur, I didn't opt for the most expensive shipping. I opted for the slowest shipping. Yeah. Well, guess what? Zappos, one of the things they do for the customer experience, they want to wow people. And they surprise upgraded me to overnight shipping. Like, how cool is that? And that, you know, it's things like that that really win customer loyalty. So it's not just when things go wrong that you can win loyalty, but it's also when things happen unexpectedly, positive surprises. So just in this room, how many of you like surprises?
I do.
Yeah. Oh, bull crap, you like surprises. You like the surprises that you want.
You like good surprises.
You like good surprises. Right. So Zappos is all about good surprises. And it's South by Southwest. So if you really want to understand how to do customer experience, I mean, you really want to study Zappos.com. And there are some great videos online from South by Southwest that you can watch. And one thing I learned at South by Southwest from Tony Hsieh, the CEO of Zappos, is he talks about how Zappos doesn't just sell shoes. They don't think that they just sell shoes. Zappos sells happiness in a box. Now, put yourself in the position of the person who's ordering those shoes. Of course, they want the shoes. But at the end of the day, what do they really want? They want to be happy. They want to feel happy. So Zappos makes sure that they sell happiness in a box. You know, compare that to other businesses. So Cold Stone Creamery. Have you ever been there?
Yes.
You know, it's ice cream. Do they sell ice cream? Of course they sell ice cream. I mean, as a customer, do I go there and get ice cream? Sure. But at the end of the day, what do they really sell?
Happiness in a cone.
Happiness in a cone or cup. You got it. And I spent some time this past week talking with the president of Cold Stone Creamery, Dan Beam, who's a great guy and has a great vision for their customer service and customer experience. And he talked about how their goal is to wow you at Cold Stone and to make sure that you know, we talked about that with Zappos. He thought that was so cool. He's like, happiness in a cone. Yeah, that's
so
great.
You're finding rock stars in this arena that are doing it well, and then what? You're going out to your client base and helping them replicate that success and helping them develop some of these strategies?
Well, Stone, I divide my time between, a couple of things. And one of them is I'm as a tech entrepreneur, I've developing and launching my own technology business. In fact, today, the open beta for my newest startup, Spitter.com is launching.
That's what I want to talk about.
So yeah. Spitter.com, we'll get to that in a minute. You know, I figure most people are less interested in the in Spitter, unless they're sports fans. But Spitter.com, think of it as kind of like a great place for sports fans to be able to get all the news and all the fan discussion. There's so much of it, it's so spread out over the web. We aggregate that into one easy to scan page stream. So think of it a little bit like sports, maybe a little bit like Twitter. That's Spitter. It's an open beta starting today, spitter.com.
Great place. I figured it was just solely dedicated to baseball when he said Spitter. I didn't know.
But you know what? The other part of what I do, I divide my time between that and I work with select high technology startups, particularly high potential startups. I've worked with companies like Zazzle, Kleiner Perkins Company in the Bay Area, Ustream.tv, which is kind of like YouTube, except it's all about live streaming video. Great group of people over at Ustream. Chris Klaus here in Atlanta, great local entrepreneur with a 3D virtual world, Kineva. I'm really impressed with what Kineva is doing, and Chris is a outstanding entrepreneur. But I also work with them in some ways with customer experience. But my focus on customer experience is really about, learning best practices and going out and putting them into play in my own businesses. And you mentioned social media before. Social media, and you also mentioned Zappos. Tony Hsieh, the CEO of Zappos, he's actively on Zappos. He did something on Twitter. So you guys are all on Twitter, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
And out there in Radioland, if you're not on Twitter, really check it out. It sounds like the dumbest thing. I thought it was the dumbest thing I had ever heard of when I heard about it. Like, why would you want to tweet about what you're doing? But it turns out it's a ultra powerful way to connect with people. And to Jack Welch, the CEO of CEO of General Electric. I mean, you know, even he's on Twitter, and he said something, Twitter makes me smarter. Well, I've got a lot of respect for Jack Welch, and when Jack Welch says Twitter makes me smarter, I mean, I think there's something there.
Well, the cool thing about Twitter is that people like you and I can connect with Tony Hsieh.
Yeah, and it is.
He's active. He's very engaged in Twitter.
And not only can you connect with him, but Tony Hsieh, how cool is this in terms of customer experience? He goes out there on Twitter, and he says, this is like last year sometime, and he says, hey, if you're a Zappos fan and you're going to be in Las Vegas any time over this weekend, that's where their company's headquartered, we're having our company picnic on Sunday. And we'd love for you to come by to our company picnic. Now, how amazing is this?
That rocks.
If you're a fan of the company and the CEO says, if you're going to be here, come to our company picnic. I mean, this is just like unprecedented.
It might be the coolest office working environment I've ever experienced or ever seen. If you've ever got a chance to get online and see digital pictures of the Zappos headquarters in Las Vegas, it's a pretty amazing place. Talk about building happiness. It's a fun place to be.
Not only can you see it in, online, but Tony makes this this promise. If you come out to Las Vegas and you're out there, get in touch with them. They'll take you on a tour. They'll even pick you up at your hotel and bring you there. This is a company that's dedicated to building great relationships with their customers. And I read that Jeff Bezos said he was so impressed with Zappos and how they do things. And that's one of the things that he liked a lot. So what do I think about that purchase from Amazon? I think it was about $800 million roughly. I think that's great combination of companies. And I'm a big fan of both companies.
Okay, so how does the guy with the little $3 million consulting firm that really buys into that whole approach, what kinds of things does he do to replicate or she do to replicate that same type of practice that you see with the Amazons and the Zappos?
I think it's looking at each point of interaction that you have with your customers and looking at it from the customer experience. I'll give you an example. So Cold Stone Creamery, and this is how I ended up talking with Dan Beam, the president of Cold Stone, last week, is, I'm just like, as I see things go right, I'm interested in understanding that and replicating it. As I see things go wrong, I'm interested in understanding what things led to those things going wrong so we can learn from that and maybe avoid them. And so it was my birthday a couple of weeks ago, and there's this one ice cream from Cold Stone that I just love. It's called... It's a creation called Mud Pie Mojo. And I'll tell you what.
Sounds good.
I just love this Mud Pie Mojo.
Sounds good for you, too.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that it is. And those folks on there who know me know that I eat a lot of organic salads and I eat pretty healthy, but I've got a weakness for this Cold Stone Mud Pie Mojo. So all day long, on my birthday, no less, I'm thinking of what? That Mud Pie Mojo. And I'm just like, I can't wait to get in there. I looked up online on coldstonecreamery.com to see for the smallest store near me, what time are they open till? They're open till 10. So at least according to the website. I show up at 9:30, and the door to the store is locked. Mm-hmm. I reach out, pull the handle. I tried a couple of times. Tried it again a couple of times. It's still locked. And it's still locked. And can you imagine the look on my face? And of course, the people at the Cold Stone Creamery employees who are in there like closing up are like, no, we don't want to like open the doors. And this is a part of the customer experience. It's not just when you're in the store, not just when you're getting ice cream in this case, but it's really the whole end-to-end customer experience. And, you really don't, if you look at that wow factor from Zappos that they're trying to have or from Amazon, you really don't want to be disappointing customers like that, particularly not on their birthdays. And, on your birthday, you can spend your birthday with just, anywhere. And so out of the infinite number of places I could have spent my birthday, I decided to spend it with Cold Stone Creamery to get my Mud Pie Mojo. So I had a good conversation with Dan Beam about this. And some lessons learned from this is Dan Beam, president of Cold Stone nationally, he has a vision for the customer experience that's dramatically different than that. And I think what we see there is one of the things that could go wrong is the classic example of the executive and the executive team that has a vision for things being one way, but then the execution of that plan either being a lot different or a wide variation. And it goes to show that it's critically important to be able to have the communication channels open so that you understand when things go wrong so that you can make them right. And in these cases, I thought, I'm going on this radio show with Stone talking about customer experience. Let's try this out. Let's see if it happens like Amazon or not, just as an experiment. And what can I learn from this that I can go back and apply for my own businesses? And so here's what I found is he said that Dan said that they have three lines of defenses or three pillars. The first thing is the person who's at the front line, the person who's the staff person making ice cream. They should be able to solve any problem and make things right on the spot. If that doesn't happen, then the store manager or the franchise owner should be able to handle things and turn things around on the spot. And they want you to have a wow experience, not a what happened experience. And the third line of defense is they have a national 800 number. And you can call into that, and they should be able to solve things and turn things around on the spot. And my experience in this case is none of those three worked. All three of them failed. So again, further disconnect between, I think, their vision and how they really the actual execution. But having spent a lot of time with the folks from Coldstone over the past week at an executive level to talk with them more about this and seek to understand how things are going with that, I have no doubt in my mind that they are absolutely committed to changing the execution of their plan. And that's impressive. And I have a lot of good things to say about the folks from Stolcone at the executive level and the folks they're having. So what can we do as entrepreneurs? I think it's put yourself in the shoes of the customer. And what does the customer really want? You know, they're looking for that happiness in a box, the happiness in an ice cream cone. How can you make them, how can you set them up for success? And I read this recently. I thought this was great. I wrote this down and highlighted it in yellow. I'd recommend that you write this down and highlight it in yellow yourself. Put it somewhere you can see it.
Well, we're going to record it.
Outstanding. So people don't always remember what you say to them, but they almost always remember how you made them feel. So again, people don't always remember what you say to them. They don't always remember what you do, but they almost always remember how you feel. So how do you want your customers to feel before, during, and after their interactions with you? I'd say start with that and then design everything in your execution to make that happen. And then have some methods in place so that you can know if that's on target or not on target. A few ways you can know if that's on target or not on target is you can there's something called Net Promoter Score. I don't know if you're familiar with this. This is a customer satisfaction measure. Now, when I was at IBM, you know, Steve, you were from right. IBM also. We we put a lot of focus on customer satisfaction and measuring it. We measured it quarterly. We looked at the scores. We put a lot of focus on that. Well, a funny thing, some smart consultants at Bain Consulting, studied this extensively. And statistically, they found that customer satisfaction does not necessarily statistically correlate with profitable growth.
Hmm.
And so that's interesting. Well, what else might you want to focus on as a metric to measure? Well, how about customer loyalty or intent to purchase? Well, it turns out none of these things statistically correlate to profitable growth. But the folks at Bain, these smart rocket science kind of guys, they did discover one metric. There's one metric they found that consistently, statistically correlated to profitable growth for a company. I don't know, when I heard this, and I heard that GE is focused on this, I heard great companies like Intuit are focused on this, I thought, maybe I should learn about this and focus on this. And it's this metric is it's one thing. Would you recommend this product or service to a colleague, family, or a member or friend? And if, when you measure that, all you have to do is ask that one question, and the follow-up question was, why do you feel that way? If you can understand that, you'll know pretty much everything you need to know. Now, a quantitative person like myself, MBA, so not just mega bad attitude, but also the degree. I put a lot of focus on, measuring, a kind of detail-oriented person. And so when I thought, you can only ask one question and find out everything you need to ask, learn? That's pretty amazing. I like the simplicity of that. It's simple. It's powerful. You can have that as an operating metric for your business. Well, what does this mean for your business? The score is from 10 to 0. 10 being absolutely you'd recommend to friends. 0 being not at all. How does this work? You take the percentage of people who said 10 or 9. Those are called promoters. Those are people who are out promoting your brand. I mean, you want these promoters. Then the people who 8 and 7s, these are neutral. You throw those numbers out. It's not that they're unimportant customers, but they're not promoters. And nor are they the next step, which is, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and zeros. These are people who are detractors. These are people who are out there, so unhappy with you.
We got to hush them up. We got to quiet them, right?
Well, it's not so much that we got to quiet them. I mean, we want to listen to what they have to say. There's that great commercial from DirecTV, I think, where they're poking fun at saying, those customers who are troublemakers, we need to quiet them down or something like that. Well, it's not so much we need to quiet them down. We need to learn from them, but we want to turn them from detractors into promoters. So turn things around. But the metric is you take the percentage who are promoters minus the percentage who are detractors. That's your net promoter score. A perfect growth engine for a company would be having what percentage promoters? 100%. For every customer you bring in, they're out recommending to friends and bringing more people in to your business. that's a perfect growth engine. What would be a perfectly bad growth engine? What percentage being net promoters?
Zero.
Zero, correct. So, Steve, prize to you.
Can you tell who in the studio audience is educated? I mean, I'm really enamored with this concept. I'm really glad we decided to record the algebra, because we love the idea.
Yeah,
but
we started with the math thing. That was a problem.
And do you know any companies that are like have perfectly bad growth engines with like 0% promoters, or even like maybe negative net promoter score, meaning they're creating more detractors than promoters on a daily basis? I know some companies. I know some entire industries like that. So,
a few government agencies, maybe.
Yeah, maybe some maybe industries like airlines, maybe some like certain cable companies that should remain nameless at the moment. But you know, I think in all our experience, we see this. But what does that mean for business? It means you're always having to spend a lot of money on marketing, and you're having to work really hard and spend a lot of money with marketing to attract new customers all the time, because you've got a leaky bucket that's constantly losing customers. Why would you want to do that? Wouldn't you prefer to have a bucket that's constantly filled up with customers who are going out getting more customers? And so this is something that I've experimented with since I was at Real Networks in Seattle, implemented at Turner Broadcasting when I was VP for New Product Development at Turner. All my clients I work with the Net Promoter Score. And Chris Klaus, a great entrepreneur here in Atlanta with Kaneva.com. When I explained Net Promoter Score to him, he's a brilliant guy. He instantly saw the potential for this. And as a consultant, one of the things that just makes your heart just feel, feel really great is when you make a recommendation and the client company actually goes out and does it, and they do it in a big way. So they put a lot of focus on Net Promoter Score. They're learning. And what you do is it becomes a metric. It's a benchmark. And no matter what your score is, good, bad, or indifferent, no matter what the score is, every quarter you're trying to increase it.
Right.
So wherever you are, and just like in life, no matter where you are in life, keep improving. And, you know, if you can improve just 1% every day in anything you do, by the end of the year, you'll just make, I mean, just do the math on that, you'll make tremendous gains. So same thing with Net Promoter Score. So,
I love this concept. Let me tell you, Dave, an example of how one of my clients puts it in action. I do marketing for a local restaurant, and we solicit customer feedback. We have cards on the tables, and they're invited to fill those out and put them in a confidential box. And it's my job to go through those and measure and quantify the data. But and every now and then, someone has an experience that's not up to their satisfaction, and we naturally, of course, take steps to address that and solve that problem. But fortunately for us, more often than not, people say, this was a wonderful experience, and we're going to tell all our friends about it. Well, we take steps to encourage that behavior. We don't just say thanks. We send them buy one, get one free cards, and we thank them, and we take other steps. And we don't want to just reward people who are complaining. We want to reward people who'd say, we're going to take the next step and help facilitate them to be promoters. So it's a phenomenal concept. Thank you for sharing that with us.
I really like that. And, you know, as we're talking about, you know, you put a lot of focus on listening to your customers. And there are two companies I wanted to call out as great examples that I've seen during the past year, and I've worked with them as customers myself, and they've provided a great example I think we all can model. And they're both on Twitter. One of them is Dell, you know, Dell Computers, and the other is Comcast. So I've got to say my experience with both of those companies with their standard customer service channel has been abysmal. Michael Dell, are you listening? Comcast, I already know you're not really listening. But
they'd listen on Twitter, though.
Standard customer service channels are just so abysmal. Everyone I talk with in preparation for this radio show, asking about companies that do it right and companies that don't. I mean, there are certain companies that happen pretty often, come up in conversation that, but those two, their standard customer service needs a lot of work. But they've got some folks who are pioneers doing some great things. So at Dell, Richard Bernier, who's on Twitter, @rich_at_dell. Rich, though, I had some issues and that weren't being resolved. And I said, you know what? I bet Dell's got some folks in social media. I'll get in touch with them and see if they can help. Rich is just out there on Twitter all day long. And what's he doing? He's looking for people who have problems with Dell computers and their Dell experience. And he's along with the rest of his team, he's helping people one at a time to solve their problems.
How cool is that?
So when I had a problem with my laptop and standard channels weren't helping, I mean, in fact, it was a miserable experience, he said, you know what? I'm going to help you get this done, and here's how we're going to do it. And I thought that was tremendous. And Comcast, a company that, you know, I just got to wonder what they're doing with their standard customer service, they've got another, they've got somebody who's like that. And I, you know, I think every one of our companies needs someone like this. At Comcast, they're on Twitter at Comcast Cares. And his name is Frank Eliason, and he's director of digital e-care. And if you just say anything about Comcast, like I'm having a problem with Comcast. So last night, season premiere of Mad Men. So one of the people on Twitter who I follow was having some problems with his Comcast service, and he's, you know, he's upset because he's not going to be able to see Mad Men. And he put something into Twitter, of course, saying, you know, problems with Comcast. What happens next is something that completely surprised him. Comcast Cares on Twitter gets back in touch with him just out of the blue. They're monitoring what's going on Twitter with the conversations, looking for opportunities to help customers. And they said, how can we help?
That is awesome. David, we're about to run out of time, but before we let you go, a couple of things. One, how can people get in touch with you to learn more about your work, about innovation and customer experience, and maybe apply some of these ideas and strategies to their own work? What's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
You can get in touch with me via email at davideckoff@gmail.com. That's davideckoff@gmail.com, or my blog, davideckoff.com. Or you can check me out on Twitter. On Twitter, I'm David Eckhoff. And
howl at the moon, and you'll be there, right?
Yeah, so, something like that. Yeah, and I actually do monitor Twitter for people talking about me, and I've got alerts on Google. If you mention my name out online, I'll see it, and I'll be in touch. And I like to be really accessible, and we'd love to hear from folks and talk business. So I'll leave with this closing thought. Another area where companies seem to go wrong is with, and I see this, it's with how they treat their employees. And think about this, how you treat your employees, your employees will never treat your customers any better than you treat your employees.
Wow.
So raise the bar on how you treat your employees. Zappos does a great job with that. Amazon does a great job with that. Many other companies. And if you're looking to have those wow experiences for your customers, think about how you treat your employees. And that can make a big difference.
Well said. Hey, one last thing. We'd love to put you on the hot seat for a moment if we can. Of course, you heard us as we were asking Steve Bistris to share a mistake that he's made at some point in his career and what he learned from it. Could we get you to do that, a personal mistake that you've made in your career and what you learned from it?
Yeah, and you know, since we're talking customer experience, do I have 60 seconds to tell the story?
No, you're good. Go ahead.
Okay, so I just told someone about this the other day. It's kind of funny, I think, for customer experience. So I used to publish a sports magazine called Inside Carolina, covered University of North Carolina basketball and football. A great way to go to a lot of games and great fun business to have. And it actually put me in an entirely different path in my career that I never could have anticipated. But I own the domain name NorthCarolina.com. Pretty sweet domain name to have.
Yeah, really?
But owning the domain name NorthCarolina.com, surprising things happen. You get people who are thinking about going to the Outer Banks on vacation. They email you. They just email into info@NorthCarolina.com. Can you tell me about the Outer Banks? Or little Timmy in junior high is doing a book report, and he emails info@NorthCarolina.com. Why? I don't know. Saying, can you tell me the state bird of North Carolina? To people saying, I'm moving to North Carolina. Can you tell me more about, like, housing? And I'm thinking, can't they see on the website that it's a sports website? It's about basketball and football. They don't see this. So then I put down frequently asked questions about the state. I actually put answers to what is the state bird? What's the state capital? What's the population?
Oh, that's funny.
Tell me how to get in touch with people about travel and tourism, et cetera. And, but every day these would come in and every day for 7 years. And by the end of 7 years, it was starting to be kind of comical, except it was really I didn't have a lot of time to be dealing with all these questions, but I did my best to point them in the right direction. Well, one day I got an email from someone and, it was like the straw that broke the camel's back. I must have been real busy and aggravated that day and who knows what. And she asked me a question about the Andy Griffith Show, which is set in North Carolina. And, I thought, it's a sports site. She's asking me a question about the Andy Griffith Show. Are you kidding me? And against all best judgment, I hit reply and I wrote a scathing email back and hit send. And, of course, you never want to do that. And but it's after 7 cumulative years of answering little Timmy's book report questions. And
they wore you down, huh?
And 2 minutes later, I got an email back from this person who's probably maybe a senior citizen. It's probably her first time getting on the internet or doing email. And she said, you don't sound like a very nice person. I felt so badly. And I wrote back to her and made that right afterwards. But, lesson learned from that is, everyone has a reason why they do things. And sometimes the reasons don't make sense to us. Sometimes, but they, there's always a reason. And I think having empathy for other people and treating other people as if you'd, as you'd want them to treat you, no matter what the situation, is the way to go. And it's something we all know. And sometimes I think the lesson learned is even when you're in, we're in the most stressful situations, you know, take a deep breath, think about how you respond, because there is a real person on the other end of that, even in the in personal communication channels that happen online. And you know that that really, you know, I think I come across you know, pretty sociable most of the time, but it really showed me that every interaction we have with people, every one of them, there's a real human being on the other side of that, no matter what the experience is. And I think we want to have our actions consistent with how we'd want our own personal brand known. And I have my own personal brand. I'm really looking for people to have those wow experiences and for people to say, oh, that was spectacular. And so your execution has to be consistent with your vision. And I'll throw that out there as a time something didn't go right, but I hopefully turn that around.
Well, for what it's worth, David, having you on the show today has definitely been a wow experience. We have thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you'll come back sometime. Todd, anything else to add? What'd you think about this show?
Oh, it was a good one. It was a good one. I look forward to listening to it again. Two wonderful, bright guests.
Well, we have to go back and listen to the algebra anyway, right?
Yeah. That's just not worth my time.
Until next time, this is Stone Payton, Todd Schnick, and the entire Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.